Dorsey, what is the Pink Lincolns?
Ooh, I don't know how to answer that one because it's like a broad thing.
Yeah, it's purposely broad. What does it mean to you? Yeah, I know. I wanted to throw one curveball at you.
It's punk-based rock, but it's not in a box. It doesn't come in a box formulated. It's like all between Chris's influences and mine, it's like, you know, I get the impression that some people listen to it and think, well, that's not what punk's supposed to be. They're breaking rules.
Deep in the bedrock of Screeching Weasel are a few bands across the U.S. that were there with us from the beginning. The Pink Lincolns and frontman Chris Barrows is the one closest to my crusted punk heart. In the snail mail days of exchanging demo tapes, Chris and I became pen pals along with the long-gone bands such as Ken Kersen's Circle, Bob Baker's Descent, Gilman Street Band Corrupted Morals, and still in action, Joe Queer from the Motherfucking Queers. Right now, you are listening to the first track on Back from the Pink Room, Miami. The Pink Lincolns formed in 1986 and have maintained an appearance in the punk scene to this very day, with its founder Chris Barrows and his right-hand man, Dorsey Martin. Together, they have recorded 5 full-length studio records and about a dozen EPs. The crucial element of this band that I feel has gone largely unappreciated is their dedication to the punk aesthetic, their continuous ability to write abrasive, straightforward punk rock that is always obnoxious and infectious to listen to and to see live. This episode features their debut album, Back from the Pink Room, released in 1988 on Chris's very own label, Greedy Bastard. The podcast contains interviews with Chris Barrows, Dorsey Martin, and the legendary drummer, Bill Stevenson, from such bands as The Descendants and Black Flag. And now I bring you Back from the Pink Room, already in session, by The Pink Lincolns.
We just tried to be like non-fashion and didn't like try to, you know, be one of those fucking bands that stand for something. We just tried to do music and rock the fuck out, you know, and tear a club up or whatever. That was about as deep as it got.
Track 2, I Got My Tie On.
I'm a cog in a wheeling, lubricated world, and I want to marry an office girl. I've got my tie on. Even when the morning paper's red, I've got my...
So from the start, Chris, where were you born, and then where were you raised?
I was born in Wichita, Kansas. I came to school in sixth grade down here. I stayed with my brother, and then I went back up after the school year was over, and then I was probably about 16-ish, and then I moved back down here to Florida, and then I was just going to be down here for a little bit. But I just stayed. It doesn't snow down here. So I've just been down here ever since. I lived in Tampa for forever, and then I moved to St. Pete about just a little over 10 years ago, I believe. And I like it here. I like it a lot. It's really cool. It's got a good vibe, nice people. I'm happy. You know, I'm in a happy place with a really very cool person. Things are really good. We got dogs, you know, they're assholes. So it's cool.
I've got a penthouse with a view. I know I've got a job to do. I've got my tie on.
Yeah, I did. I thought you were born and bred in Tampa. I don't think I've ever actually talked to you about where you were actually born. So
yeah, Wichita. It was interesting living there, like from my memory. But I was just pretty aimless. I just got into a lot of trouble and shit like that. Coming down here, it was a good move for me.
Dorsey, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Oklahoma. And I moved to Florida when I was 10.
What brought your family from Oklahoma to Florida?
Well, my mom and my stepdad were in a business, and a lot of the people in that business used Florida as a winter quarters, and I guess they thought it would be helpful for their business.
Track 3, I'm So Polite.
I let old ladies get in my way. Straight off the curb, I let them stay. I've always told them, stand in line and file without work.
Where do you feel your pursuit of being a musician derived from?
I just started liking rock music, and, well, I've always liked all kinds of music, especially when I was a kid. I was fascinated with music, and I remember my aunt had a piano, and I wasn't allowed to touch it, so whenever she was out of the room, I would go over there and tack out little tunes on it, like Three Blind Mice and stuff, and I just...
what was your actual personal first instrument that you owned?
I think the first one I bought was a drum set.
I know you mostly as a guitarist, Dorsey. Do you still play a bunch of different instruments, or did you just sort of gravitate towards the guitar?
I gravitated toward the guitar because I started playing in bands, and I just didn't like the way some of the guitar players played my songs. I already had a guitar, and I was writing songs, and it's like, I'm sitting in the back, and these guys are changing my song, so why don't I just play guitar?
I wear lights in my neighborhood, always do the things that I did for my mom.
And you were on, were you on drums at that point?
Yeah.
Do you still play drums today?
No, I haven't played drums in probably 16 years.
Are there any musicians or any artists in your family that you know of?
I have very few family members left, and the ones that were alive when I was younger didn't play any instruments.
So no instruments? Any like artists or anything like that?
No. Let me think. Oh, my father played some stringed instruments and the harmonica, but I never heard him play them.
He just told you that he used to play them?
Yeah, my mom told me that. Played a violin and the harmonica and a couple other stringed instruments.
Chris, did you discover punk rock before you moved out of Kansas to Florida?
Yes. Okay, let me see. I remember I was stealing a Stooges Raw Power 8-track from Woolworths in Kansas.
Dance to the beat of the living dead. Loose sleep, baby, and stay away from bed. Raw Power shoulder from a running to.
I had a jacket on, and I had it shoved into my sleeve. And this was a long time ago. This would have been mid-70s. And, you know, there was no, like, no microchips or anything like that back then. My sister and her boyfriend, I was with them, and they didn't know that I had done that. And so we were walking out the door, and at the door, I'm sure it was like a manager and an employee type thing, and they were talking. And the 8-track slid down my sleeve and fell out, and it landed on the floor. My sister and her boyfriend just stopped and looked at it, and looked at me like, what the fuck? And the guys that worked there just looked at me, and so I just picked it up and put it in my pocket for when we left. That was Iggy and the Stooges. That would have been like back pretty much when that came out, or shortly after it came out. And that was just a big one. I was just like, holy fuck, shit, this doesn't sound like anything, you know, I've heard before. Not in Kansas, you know, there was nothing in Kansas. It was extremely boring.
Track 4, Temporary Friends with Chris Barrows.
Now, I'm going to go on to this next one first before I ask that. Can you trace any artistic influence from your family? Like, do you think you inherited any propensity towards art or music in general from?
Yeah, my mom was really creative. She was always like making my clothes, and she would make like toys and shit. Like, she'd get like those old fashioned clothespins, the ones that don't move. They're just kind of like pegs. She'd make little soldiers and put little uniforms on them and shit. She was like really creative. She'd just make cool stuff at Christmas.
One yet, but you'll say, I know it doesn't matter. It never ends. Even though you're twice my size, temporary friends.
And I think I got my dad's sense of humor because he had a really, really super fucked up sense of humor. And I take after him a lot, I'm sure. So, and he was a cool guy. He just kind of, he didn't have too many friends, mm-hmm. you know. He just came home, he was the family guy, and he did that the best he could, you know. And but he was just his own guy. I kind of take after him a lot.
You talked about your sharing a fucked up humor. Do you have any incidences that you remember about your father that sort of expressed that?
Yeah, we used to go to this lake, Lake Afton, and the water was really nasty there, but for some reason we used to go there. So there was some kids, and there was like a, not a cliff, but an overhang, kind of where the man stuck out kind of over the water. And the kids were talking about riding a bike and like riding it into the water. And they're like, no, we shouldn't. My dad like egged him on. And he's like, I know you guys could do it if you got way, way back and pedaled really fast. And I remember this because I was into, you know, I was just like, wow, see what'll happen. I was always into that, see what'll happen if we do this. So they did it, and they got way back and they did it, and they went way the fuck out in the water. It was shallow, but the kid went over the handlebars and everybody was like, whoa, and then he got up and he was all excited. My dad had a fucking maniacal grin on his face. I mean, he just like, I'd never seen him like that. I remember that day specifically. My dad was a cool guy.
Track 5, Age. I just want to get a little bit more of your influences, like some like basic questions. Where do you, not even just punk.
Ziggy Stardust, I got that when I came out. I was like, holy shit. And Roxy Music. Now that wasn't punk rock, but at the time it was. You know, you go to school and say that you listen to the New York Dolls, they beat you up because nobody understood shit like that. Try it, won't pick it up, take them lights away. Try it, won't pick it up, don't take your life. It got my attention, just the differentness of it.
It goes anywhere from art rock. I don't know, I liked Robert Fripp a lot. I can't emulate him because it's too complex. I like stuff like Robin Trower, Brian Eno, Captain Beefheart a whole lot, Motley Hoople, The Beatles. She said, the Beatles were a big influence because they wrote songs different from other rock bands. They had that traditional pre-rock pop influence with their song structures and their chords, and I learned most of my non-bar chords from them. Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.
Who could hang a name on you? My older sister used to listen to the Flowers album a lot, the Rolling Stones. That was kind of a big influence. Just I like the Stones a lot more than the Beatles.
Track 6, I Got a Gun.
Dorsey and you have been the two consistent members of Pink Lincoln since the very beginning. How did you meet, and how did that relationship eventually end up with you playing in a band with them?
He used to be in a band called Not Much, They were cool. They were like punk. He played drums in it. I had a friend named Ben Hughes, and he played guitar in the band, and he was a friend. So I'd go see him to watch Ben play. Dorsey was always an eccentric character, even back then. I didn't really know him for a while. I just see him around.
I had a couple of friends that I had been in bands with. One was a bass player, and one of them was a guitar player. And we decided to get together one night out here at my house and play some stuff. And they brought Chris over, and he had his guitar with him. After meeting him, I thought he was a pretty cool guy. And we played a bunch of Wire songs that he knew. I had never heard Wire before. That's great.
The band I was doing with Dorsey and Ben and a guy named Alan, we had a few cool songs, and we did like a cassette recording, and then it just kind of fell apart. Dorsey was doing like a really artsy band called Veal Rifles. Kerry, the singer, he had a theatrical background, so they always had to do a crazy presentation and throw a big weird artsy twist into it. And I played guitar in that for a while with Dorsey. And then after that kind of fell apart, then me and Dorsey just kind of started linking. So it was a slow evolution, just, you know, seeing between Jimmy and John in one aspect, and then Dorsey, and then it just kind of came together, just kind of like by itself that way.
Dorsey, how did this lead to forming the Pink Lincolns?
As far as I remember, he wanted to record his own songs in a studio, but it wasn't a band yet. He asked me and another drummer to play on them, so it wasn't a band, it was just like recording his songs. And I played on some of them in the studio, and another drummer played on some.
None of us were like really punk or hard punk or whatever. I kind of wanted to try to go that way musically. And it's kind of cool because Pink Room, it is pretty obnoxious for an album. And that's kind of cool that it came together that way as much as it did. Yeah, I walk through the valley of death. I shall
share no evil. Track 7, Man's Best Friend. Chris, we first met through the mail. We were pen pals since 1986.
You sent a cassette of your band and said that you wanted a cassette of my band and that you were trying to organize and do a compilation cassette. And in your letter, you used the word organized like maybe 20 times. That's the one thing I remember about that. I said, wow, these guys are going to try to get organized and do a tape and do some other stuff. It's like, cool. So I sent you guys a tape, and then I listened to yours, and it's like, holy shit, this is pretty cool, you know? And then you guys wrote, and yeah, this is pretty cool. And so we've just been in touch ever since. When you guys put your first album out, I was like, holy shit, this is badass. And then I remember the first time I ever heard Boo Get Away. I put that on, and I dropped the needle on it, and it started playing. Just had a really just an overwhelming feeling. It's like, holy shit, this is like great. This is just like, holy fuck, these guys just they're going for it, you know. I remember that. I'll take a beer and a bottle of tears. I need a beer to feel like
a man. Track 8, Suburbicide. Dorsey, a lot of the songs on Back from the Pink Room were originally recorded for a demo that I had gotten from Chris Barrows back in 86. You were on both of these. Was the first demo tape like a garage recording, or was it in the studio?
I think the first time we recorded anything, it was in Morristown Studio in Tampa, which was an actual studio.
The demo, I thought, was great, but the recording of the record Back from the Pink Room is full of energy and sounds great, and even has a lot more guitar play on it. Do you remember much of the recording?
That was recorded at Morris Sound as well. And I don't really remember a whole lot about recording back from the Pink Room. But we had practiced quite a bit before we had gone in there.
Was Pink Lincoln's big on rehearsal or just average?
At first it was. And then it, late in the, toward the end, or the second half of the Pink Lincoln's, or even earlier, it became a thing where we only practiced before we had a show or before we were going to record. And that was frustrating for me.
I always think you improve the more you rehearse, and if you only do one live show, you don't really have time to get that sort of live feel back into your fingers.
Yeah, that was, that part of it was something I didn't like about the Pink Lincoln's, because in my previous bands, we would just go to practice and we would jam and turn out songs rather than going to practice for the specific purpose of recording or learning a new song. So it was kind of backwards for me, and I didn't get it.
Track 9, Victims' Rights.
This is a quote from you. Let's see why I have this. Okay, yeah. So you said, there's no real profound meaning to it. A lot of people have read into it, but the truth is we were just sitting around a band without a name, and Dorsey came up with the Pink Lincoln's. It had a sort of ring to it, so we just ran with it. It doesn't really mean anything. Now my question is, do you feel that the name of the band has guided any of the creative force behind the band?
I remember that practice. It was when we practiced in a really hot shed, and we were sitting there, and he said it, and the reaction was just everybody was quiet, and then everybody just started laughing fucking really hard because it was just so stupid, and then everybody got quiet. My first impression was, I guess it means like a dick, like a wiener or something. With Dorsey, you never know. He comes up with funny shit. So it's like nobody questioned it, nobody said anything.
Time to stand up for your rights or they'll take them away.
We had a short list of names, and they were all just fucking stupid. And so that would have probably been the most intelligent one. But nobody questioned it. Like, what does this mean? We had a show coming up or some shit like that. You know, we just had to come up with something, you know, then. That was it. You know, we just ran with it. And I don't think it really guided our musical angle or anything, because if anything, people thought that we were like a rockabilly band. It didn't sound like a punk band. And aside from the it might mean a dick thing, in a way, I kind of, I don't know Dorsey's line of thinking. I thought this, maybe he grabbed like a color and the name of a president, like Black Flag and Dead Kennedys. Like, I don't know if that was part of his, like, putting Pink Lincoln's together. I don't know. Because it didn't necessarily mean Abe Lincoln. It didn't necessarily mean a Chrysler Lincoln. So, I don't know. We just never questioned it. We had a stupid punk rock band name. So, cool. We just ran with it.
Track 10, Not For Sale.
What was the effect, do you think, Chris, of Screeching Weasel and the Pink Lincoln's meeting, crossing paths?
Well, that was big for me, because it showed that a bunch of guys could jump into a car with their guitars and fucking play the other side of the country. And that's cool. I mean, you guys opened the door for us doing that. You know, it's like, holy fucking shit. It is possible. I've seen it. That first tour, you guys were in a car. And so the first time that we went up and played up there, we were in a station wagon with all of our equipment. I didn't have enough money for a van. So we could only rent a station wagon. It was really fucked up. We had to strap a bunch of shit on the top, and it rode really low to the ground, and the temperature gauge was riding kind of warm the whole way up there and the whole way back, and it smelled like the fucking farts when we checked it back in. But one time we went and we played Atlanta in Jimmy's truck, and so there was three people could fit on the inside of the cab because it was a small Toyota truck. and then one person had to ride on, so there was just enough room to ride on the amp. And I think we did Gainesville and then Atlanta and then something else that way. It was pretty stupid because, I mean, we were older by then, you know, we were probably in our 30s, you know. You start out however you can, you know, you just do it, start doing it. Sweet.
This next interview is with Bill Stevenson. Bill produced a later Pink Lincoln's record called Pure Swank, but I include him here because he has some very good insight into Chris and the Lincolns.
Most of my listeners will know who you are, but can you give us a rundown of who you are and what you do?
Well, okay. I'm Bill Stevenson. As a teenager, I started the band The Descendants with my buddies in high school. Later, I ended up playing on a lot of records and tours with the band Black Flag. And then later than that, I started another band called All. And somewhere in there, I kind of got interested in recording. About 21 years ago, I opened a recording studio called The Blasting Room here in Fort Collins, Colorado, where I've been living for 21 years. Yeah, I've just kind of been doing music stuff most of my life, you know, and most of it having a kind of a direct connection to the to punk rock or to the first wave of L.A. punk rock. Although at the schoolyard, I might just be known as Miles' father or Maddie's father. I don't know.
Bill, you've been a big influence in the world of punk music as a musician and also as an engineering production person. Has engineering always been an interest? And how did you come to the production side of music?
Yeah, I pin my producer thing or whatever, knack, I pin it to there's a particular moment as a kid where I got a hold of these Beatles alternate versions and alternate mixes. It was an album called Beatles Rarities. I remember that Love Me Do sounded really different than the Love Me Do that I was familiar with. And I couldn't figure out what it was. I was just a kid, but I would listen to it. And I said, there's something wrong with this. Something isn't right. I didn't know what the terms were for it, but I remember eventually deciding that the bass guitar had been tuned too high compared to the other instruments. So he was playing the song correctly, but the whole instrument was tuned too high. Now, of course, now we know this is called sharp. You know, the bass is tuned sharp. But as a kid, I just remember going, something's wrong. And it was like at that moment, I think I realized that I had this interest in kind of diving into songs and looking at the subparticles, you know, rather than just the song as a whole. And then when I got just a little bit older, when I wasn't a little kid, then I found myself playing instruments and writing songs, and then I was kind of in it. And then when my band got good enough to where we could record, I found myself interested in that stuff and maybe trying to push the engineer out of the way so I could piddle around with EQ a little bit and this sort of thing. And it's funny because that resulted in a lot of horrible sounding Descendants and All records because I really didn't know what I was doing, but I did have interest in it.
Track 11, Black Circles. I hear footsteps in the night.
I'll stay awake till morning's light. Bill, when and how did you first meet Chris Barrows?
I think I met Chris in 84 on a Black Flag show at the Cuban Club in Tampa. He had written to Descendants before and, like, bought our 7-inch record through the mail from us. So I kind of already knew who he was because he was, to be honest, I think Chris was our very first band that wasn't in our city, you know, that didn't go to my high school. We go way, way back. I value his friendship tremendously. I have a ton of respect for him. But Descendants hadn't toured. So the first time that I got myself to Florida was in Black Flag, and so I think he came up to me. I'm pretty sure that's how it went down.
How did this introduction to Chris Barrows and the Pink Lincolns lead to you working with them?
I feel like our bands were kind of almost an afterthought to our friendship. I don't know, I didn't really know about Pink Lincolns a lot until we had a day off or something, and I next thing I knew, I was in some studio recording Pink Lincolns, and I didn't, I didn't know much about them, really. I just knew Chris. But I really enjoyed what little interaction I was able to have with Dorsey. I really enjoyed that. I liked the way his mind works.
You know, when I see them in person, when I see them on stage, those two are like two of the most unique people I know in punk rock. They're just so soft-spoken, but when they're on stage, they're just weird and cool, you know?
That's a really good term for it, unique. I was trying to think, well, what am I going to say about Chris? I've known Chris since I reached puberty, and I don't know what I'm going to say about Chris. But yeah, he's just an entity unto himself. He got into, you know, pre-punk, like post rock and roll, pre-punk, and into punk. The thing about it that spoke to him, he never let go of that and got old and got corporate and got conservative. He still represents everything that we had in our minds when we were all teenagers, and he still has that all.
I guess the other thing I want from you, Bill, is if you remember anything about them being in the studio with you. Is there anything that sticks out?
Oh boy,
I know.
We did it so quickly. It all happened so quickly that it was more like just a shuffle to get the mics up and get it done.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have any real stories other than, I mean, the impression I got was that this was a band that really didn't want to be bothered with, like, sort of the procedure of studio, the procedure of recording, production. They just wanted to play their songs and get it on tape. That's a really big part of what made the first wave of punk rock so bitchin', is that everything is just so... I think the word raw gets overused, but I mean, everything was so uneffectuated, unadorned. It was what it was, you know, when you hear one of those records, then if you went and saw the band, I mean, that's what they sounded like. There wasn't a lot of tomfoolery going on, because they impacted me at a time when I was just beginning to learn about studio tomfoolery. But it was like, no, none of that for this record. This record doesn't need any of that.
I think someone asked you about politics in the song, and you said, politics suck. It has nothing to do with music. What is it that your type of punk rock does? I know you said before that you and Dorsey just chose to sing about whatever you wanted, but it's not like bubblegum pop, sugary, melodic music. There is some social comment in it. So what is that if it's not political?
I don't want to tell people what to think. A lot of songs, I just kind of say what I think, or songs are weird to write. I mean, from the most part, it's kind of from the heart. But on some songs, there's a small percentage where you just got to kind of make shit up to make the song fit together, you know? So it's like some of the shit I mean, and some of it's just like making the words fit the music or whatever. I don't know. For the most part, it's pretty heartfelt. But I don't want to tell people how to live or how to think. That's bullshit. You know, it's what the fuck do I know? You know, I'm not the world's most perfect fucking person. I don't have my shit together all that tight, you know. So I've got no purpose or no reason to tell people how they should be or how they should think. So if that's probably as politically inclined as I could think about that subject or whatever like that. Because too many people shoot their fucking mouth off about this is how people should be, and you know, the bands that make speeches and shit. It's like, fuck that, you know. We always just kind of wanted to rock the fuck out and not, you know, try to change people's beliefs.
Track 12, Bad TV. You and Chris have been working together on and off for, almost 30 years. What is it about each other that has caused this continuing musical bond, do you think?
I guess he understands how I work, and sometimes it's useful to him, and the same for me.
Now, can you describe that a little bit more? What is that? How do you guys work?
Well, he knows what I can do, and I know what he does, and he's a very underrated rhythm guitar player. You know, he doesn't like to play guitar on stage, but
right.
I was in a band with him before Pink Lincoln, and we were a four-piece, and then we decided that we asked him to play rhythm guitar with us, and he was really good at it.
I always thought that was interesting about him too. But I mean, he's such a good front man once he's without a guitar in his hand. So I don't complain because he's so riveting to watch, I think.
Yeah. He keeps the crowd entertained.
I was in Weasel where Ben was writing most of the stuff. And you had said earlier about moving a guitar so people would play, or, you know, you would play the songs the way you wanted to. Was it hard for you to be, not second fiddle, but he wrote most of the stuff. So how did you let, what was your outlet?
Well, it was his band, so he started it, but he let me write like 35 to 40% of the songs after we got going, so I was fine with that.
Did you write lyrics too, or just mostly music?
At first, it started out, one or the other would write the lyrics or the music, or sometimes we'd do a whole song ourselves. If I didn't feel like having to write lyrics and he had some lyrics already, we would collaborate and put them together. Toward the end, it was more like me and him were writing independently.
Oh, I think you were leading in a neat direction. I was just curious as to the nature of the friendship. Was it more based on the idea of
basically music? Because I mean, we didn't like go out and hang out together too much or anything like that. Actually, probably not at all. It was basically the music thing. You know, he's got a fucked up sense of humor. I've got a fucked up sense of humor. You know, as far as being in the band, like with our songs, like when he'd put songs in or when I would put songs in, we're both pretty stubborn about stuff. We both know what we want to do. So there was a little bit of headbutting on as far as like songs and stuff like that, but not a lot. But we both, you know, we weren't doing it to be assholes. We just wanted the band to be as good as possible. So we would kind of check each other on each other's songs type stuff. And at the time, that might have caused a little bit of friction or whatever, but in the long run, it was to make the songs better. You'd be in any situation with people. Me and Dorsey spent 20 years or more in that band, on and off. So, I mean, there's plenty of room for, you know, to be friends and plenty of room to be assholes to each other, too.
Yeah, I agree. I think relationships that go over that long period of time are just very complex. I'm just always interested in the dynamics of that.
Yeah, we're both kind of, you know, stubborn people. So I'm sure that didn't make it easier on either one of us. So.
But also probably helped form the sort of identity of the band, I would imagine.
I don't know if we did have an identity.
Track 13, Velvet Elvis.
Chris, have you ever gotten beat up from on stage? Went to a rubbish sale
on some old lady's lawn. No, a girl jumped up on stage one time when we were doing one of the first shows that we ever did. The second or third show that we ever did was playing with the Circle Jerks. And it was a tall stage, and it was in a municipal auditorium or something. And I was talking a lot of shit. I had really long hair back then, so the punk rock people didn't really like me. And I was talking a lot of shit about punk rock or something. And so some punk girl jumped up on stage and just starts taking swings at me. And so I had to kind of like push her back off the stage. I forgot what the original question was.
Oh, I was just curious because you really push the boundaries sometimes of you're just very aggressive on stage. So and the way you try to instigate, I just didn't know if it had ever gone awry.
No. Saw that Velvet Elvis and I want it on my wall. It'd be my presentation. A couple times in a not like, you know, riots or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm sure there have been instances of, you know, some bumping around or something like that, you know. I've done more damage to myself on stage than anybody else has ever done to me. So I could easily say that. I mean, I've got a fucked up back, a fucked up hip, you know, I've fucked up my teeth on the microphone and shit like that. So if I would have sang pop music, you know, none of that shit would have happened.
I just remember when I first heard the band, you can never, you know, judge a singer just by his voice, but you were probably the one that was most different from what I had pictured, so, and I hear that often, so I'm very interested in that. Was that the first voice that came out when you start to sing for Greg Lincolns?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a singer. You know, actually, lately, I'm kind of toying with it. After all these fucking years, I'm kind of doing it different. Because what I used to do was just yell. Just the same monotone yelling. And it worked for me for a long fucking time. And then I quit smoking cigarettes lately. Maybe like 10 years ago or so. And I was smoking like 3 packs a day. And that helped give me a really cool edge to my... When I listen to my old shit, if I hear it, you know, it's like, holy fuck, this sounded pretty fucking badass. But if I yell like that now, it just comes out different. Mm. So I'm looking at singing differently.
And now we have come to the last track on Back from the Pink Room. When I had spliced and edited the section to go over this last song, I listened to the song again and decided it was best just to leave the song as it is. This is one of my favorite songs, and if you're listening to this at work, you might want to turn it down. So here is the last track, track number 14, Fuck Sex.
What do you say when you've had too much beer? What do you say when your girlfriend looks queer? What do you say when it just makes you sick? What do you say when you cock too quick?
In a review, Chris, someone had asked you about your sort of how do you take music and putting out records, and you responded, "We're on our own schedule. We don't have to put out an album every year, whether it sucks or not. You know, we just when we have shit we want to do, we do it." So my question to you, Chris, is: so you never really pursued music as a career? Is that true?
True. I enjoyed it. I mean, I did it as an enjoyment type thing, I think. Like, there was ways back then that we could have dug in and got some money out of it, but we were just kind of doing it for laughs, more or less, you know? As long as we could get by, we were happy. We were just happy doing it, you know? If I could go back and do it differently, yeah, I probably would. You know, I know a lot more now than I knew then. But we were pretty fucking genuine. I mean, we were looking back on it. I don't feel bad about it at all. We really fucking meant it, you know. And we weren't worried about shit. We'd just get up on stage and fucking go at it, you know. And because we would all be shit faced. but it was a lot of fun, you know. And there's a lot of parts of it that I remember, and some of it I look back on like, oh, fuck, you know, I was an asshole. But some of it I look back on like, holy shit, that was a lot of fun, you know. So,
yeah.
Now, this is a personal kind of question for me to ask, that I'm interested in this sort of idea of friends, and I'm just interested in what you think. Were you friends, and do you consider yourself still friends?
I still consider him a friend. He's a stand-up guy. We don't always agree on things, but he came to my mom's funeral, one of the few friends that did. We just don't see each other because he lives on the other side of the bay, and I don't even go out anymore, so...
Yeah.
but I still consider him my friend.
I think it's really impressive that you two can work both, like, sort of in a band and business and remain a friendship for that long. I think that's admirable.
Thank you for listening to episode 19 of Jughead's Basement, featuring the Pink Lincolns back from the Pink Room. Next up on our punk rock roster is the Dutch band from Rotterdam, The Apers, with their 2002 self-titled record. Along with co-host Sarah Ramone, we will bring you interviews with all four members who played on the record. So stay in the know and check back on our Facebook and webpage. And lastly, if you are enjoying this podcast and would like to help out, please donate some cash or share episodes with friends and also with your lesser internet friends. Thank you, and godless blessings to all of you. Good night, or good day, or afternoon.